Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Lewis. We head to Williamsburg for today's show. We'll chat with two scholars at the College of William & Mary, both in different disciplines. We'll get a chance to catch up with law professor Jeffrey Bellin. He worked as a law clerk for Supreme Court nominee Judge Merrick Garland. We'll also talk with William & Mary's neurodiversity scholar in residence. John Elder Robison is the author of the new book, Switched On, a memoir of brain change and emotional awakening. It's Robison's fourth book on life with autism. Stay with us after this news from NPR. Good afternoon. It's a beautiful, beautiful spring afternoon in Hampton Roads. Would have been nice to have this weather yesterday, would it not? Just saying. But we've got it today, and it is beautiful and glorious, and we have a great show for you today. So I'm glad you stopped by for this Monday afternoon. We're going to be talking a little later in the program with John Elder Robison. He is the College of William & Mary's neurodiversity scholar in residence. He has lived with autism all his life. He's about 58 years old now, but didn't get his diagnosis until he was 40. He's the author of four best-selling books, the latest of which is called Switched On, a memoir of brain change and emotional awakening. It's a fascinating story of these brain stimulation techniques they did with him that introduced him to emotions that had been previously shut off for him in his brain. And he talks about what that experience was like. He is at the College of William & Mary as a scholar, but as you'll learn a little bit later, he had an early experience as a child at Colonial Williamsburg that certainly helped inform his own work and his own presence there today. So we'll talk with him just a little bit later in the program. He's going to be doing a talk tonight at 7 at the Tucker Theater there on the campus of William & Mary in observance of the fact that next month, April, which starts on Friday, friends, is National Autism Awareness Month. Can you believe we are at April already? I don't even know where the first quarter went. I just have no idea. I feel like I sleepwalked through the whole thing. 8 minutes past the hour. First, though, we are very happy to welcome back, and with our apologies, Jeffrey Bellin, who's the Campbell Research Professor of Law at the College of William & Mary's Law School. Jeffrey was supposed to join us, I think it was last week or so, and we were a bit overtaken by news events, and we asked if he would mind joining us another day when we could talk with him in a more full experience, and so we're glad that today is that day. Jeffrey Bellin, good to have you back with us today. Thank you for being here.
Great, thank you.
So I note that you were not on the short list for the Supreme Court. Sorry about that, my friend. Sorry about that.
I've got a long time to go, though.
Well, that's true. You are fairly young in your career here, so hope springs eternal, as they say. But someone that you know personally certainly was the nominee, and I wonder how surprised you were when you saw Judge Merrick Garland in the Rose Garden with President Obama being announced as the next Supreme Court nominee.
Yes, it was thrilling for me, and I'll just give you a little background on how I do know him. So if you're a law student, kind of one of the best things you can do out of law school is to clerk for a judge. And so about 16 years ago, that was my first job out of law school, was a clerkship with Judge Merrick Garland. And I always tell students when they ask me about whether to do a clerkship that for me, what was so great about the experience was that this was the first kind of legal figure I got to know in my career, and he just is such a model of how people want judges to act. And so kind of having that as my first year working closely with someone like that, is very smart, does everything by the book and, you know, everything the right way. That was just a great way to start your legal career, because what happens, your listeners may have a sense of this, is that not every lawyer is that way.
And so
And so it's useful to have in your mind as you move through the profession that there are these people out there who are, you know, really noble examples of how the law is supposed to work.
So the Chief Justice, John Roberts, is quoted as saying, "Anytime Judge Garland disagrees, you know you're in a difficult area. So he really is a well-esteemed judicial mind, it sounds like. I mean, I think it sounds like people from all sides sort of respect what he goes through to come to his opinion. And when he comes to an opinion that's different from theirs, they might just sort of sit down and take a look.
Yeah, and that's what I think is so great about him. So you were asking if I was surprised. I was surprised that he was chosen to do this. He's not kind of someone that is going to fire up the president's base as mm-hmm. in terms of politics, but he's someone that the kind of people who have worked with him know and respect. And the great thing about that, and I think the thing the country could really use and the Supreme Court could really use, is someone who kind of convinces other people or works with other people to get to a consensus position. So we'll have, you know, a court with Judge Garland on it, I think, would be a court where there are fewer kind of fractured decisions and more kind of narrow consensus decisions that people can look at and, you know, kind of generally agree with, instead of saying my side won, my side lost, maybe more decisions where, you know, you don't get everything you want, but you kind of come to a middle ground.
So we're in this hyper-political environment now, and certainly the presidential race is casting an extra shadow over that. So we do, I think, tend to look at things through a political lens. But one of the things you've said is that this nomination really sort of takes us to what the court is really supposed to be about, and what sometimes gets complicated when an opening appears, close-ish to the expiration of a presidential term.
Right, and that's what I think. I think the Supreme Court, you know, shouldn't be political or shouldn't be a partisan institution, right? Obviously, there's going to be things that play into it, and it's political in the sense that the president has to appoint someone and the Senate has to confirm them. But I think, you know, as lawyers and as people, we think of the rule of law as depending on something other than the judge's political preferences or ideology. And just to my mind, you know, Judge Garland, as much as any judge, epitomizes that kind of, you have a case before him. And this is why people respect him, because no matter, you know, if you have a case before him, you know he's going to dive into the record and roll up his sleeves and look at what the law says and come out with an opinion that you may not agree with, but won't look like he was trying to get somewhere. It will just look like he was trying to follow the law. And you'll have a sense that he really listened and had an open mind and kind of resolved it in good faith. And I think that's what people want in a judge. And that's why I was really happy with this appointment and hope that it makes it to confirmation.
13 minutes past the hour. It's 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. One of the critiques of Judge Garland is that he is more moderate from the person that he would be replacing, which is Justice Antonin Scalia, who died, in late February. So I guess I wonder about that, Jeffrey. Do you on the court always sort of replace with the like of the person who has left? Or how does that typically work? Obviously, that's a presidential place, so there is a political specter there, I suppose.
Right, and you know, certainly you're not going to get someone just like Justice Scalia from President Obama. So it can't be that you have to match the person prior. And then, you know, I think just everyone's unique, and there's going to be places where, you know, you're just not going to be able to find, even if you could, if you wanted to, you couldn't find justices that are going to match up exactly with the prior justice because the law changes and, you know, the issues that come before the court are going to change. So I think it's not, the premise is not you try to keep the court exactly how it was. The court has certainly changed over time. And, you know, what I think it should be is you look for someone who's highly qualified. And to me, you know, in this moment, you know, the other thing you look for, and this is what I liked about this appointment, you look for a way to kind of reach out to the other side. You know, President mm-hmm. Obama didn't pick the person that, you know, probably people were urging him to pick, didn't pick someone that was really exciting, kind of progressive judge. He instead, you know, picked someone that's pretty close to the middle and someone who had support across the aisle. And I thought that was that might be the right answer at this time.
You know, it's interesting, too, because there's that old critique, certainly popular in our business, which is that, you know, if both sides are criticizing you. You suppose you don't know what you're supposed to do. And in some respects, that's the case for Merrick Garland. Liberal activists are not happy necessarily with him around his the sense that he's less sympathetic to the rights of criminal defendants than many of his liberal friends and even some conservative colleagues on the appeals court might be. And he really, you know, that piece of it really seems interesting that he does sort of seem right in the middle there.
Right. And you know, in looking at his opinions and things, you know, I think that and the criticisms that are kind of slowly bubbling up here and there, it is funny that they're from both sides. You can see them from both sides. And I think in both instances, they're not very strong. They're kind of weak, and often someone, you know, there's this kind of floating out there that he's anti-Second Amendment rights, but the things they point to are not, you know, not real. They're not actual votes on Second Amendment issues. And then the same thing on the other side of the aisle. There's suggestions about various cases. When you look at the case, I mean, really, you know, what it looks like is that, or to me at least, and knowing him, that it's not about a result for him. It's about a process. And when you do that, you know, you're going to upset both sides, and that's what we see here. Because I think both sides, although they won't say this, they're looking for results, right? If you're arguing before the court, you want a result more than you want the fair process necessarily. If you're one of the parties in the case.
So, without Justice Scalia and with a fairly entrenched political circumstance underway right now, the court stands at 8-8, and so now we have to sort of put our political hat on, and ask, you know, what do you think are his prospects? Republicans saying we're not going to, I guess he's getting some interviews and some talks and some informal chats, but no indication that this is going to move much forward.
Right. And it seems like there's kind of two ways this works out for confirmation. One is that the Republican senators agree to hold hearings, and this could be motivated by, I've seen some polls that suggest that most people think they should at least hold hearings. And so maybe as a political calculation, they'll do that or because they think it's good for the institution. But the second possibility is the Republicans in the Senate will wait till the election or close to the election. And if it looks like a Democrat's going to win, then they might move forward. There'll be a couple months before the actual new president would come in. And they could confirm him then, thinking that he's better than whoever they would get from the Democratic president. So either of those would result in confirmation. I think the first choice is just better for the institution because it doesn't look so political.
You know, it's interesting, too, because if you think about the prospects for a Supreme Court nominee, I was reading something where they said, you know, really, whoever gets appointed may or may not actually make it to the bench. And what struck me with seeing Judge Garland in the Rose Garden is that, you know, for him, this is a tremendous honor, and it's the pinnacle of what he's worked very hard for all his life. And, you know, you sort of get the sense that whatever way this goes, he's going to be okay with it. It's not going to change who he is. You know what I mean? I suppose that's what you want at some level, somebody who is not so wedded to the prestige, but really wedded to the law.
Right. I think he's pretty comfortable with who he is at this stage. And I actually have worked with him. So I've known him since I clerked, but then I've worked with him more recently as well. And he's someone that's very comfortable in his skin. And I think while it's a huge honor to be nominated and he'd love to be confirmed, I think he'll make it through either way.
Either way.
But one thing I'll say that's kind of striking about this is if they don't even give him a hearing, it will, just like you say, it'll be, you know, they'll just be, we'll move further down this path of, you know, of blocking things, you know, not on the merits, but just because you can. And it's just, you know, the next step in the process will be even worse. And, you know, it's already kind of pretty close to a broken process. And this, if this kind of succeeds in blocking him, not because of anything about him, but just because it was politically in one party's interest to block it, it seems like then the other party's going to do that. And then we'll just kind of go on with a dysfunctional process.
Yeah.
Indefinitely.
It strikes me that the more polling that may come out around the people's interest in seeing this nomination at least move forward to the extent that there are hearings, that could be influential. One wonders. At the moment, though, we have this 4-4, so we have an 8-person court. And so what that means is, as I understand it, is that cases that come before the court, if there is a tie vote, whatever the lower court has decided is then upheld because there's not a majority of justices saying we should overturn it. Is that correct?
Right. And it's, so it's upheld. They had one last week, and it's just like a one-sentence order that'll say affirmed by an equally divided court. And what they mean is that the decision below will just stand because it didn't get reversed. So whatever the result in the lower courts, that will stand. But the problem there is that that will be the law just for that one jurisdiction. So say it's in our jurisdiction, the Fourth Circuit, which is a couple states around Virginia, that'll be the law in the Fourth Circuit. But if there's another court in another circuit, the Fifth Circuit, say like down in Texas, that has reached the opposite conclusion, then the law will just be unclear. And that's what the Supreme Court's for. It's to kind of make one law for the whole country. And if you just have the Supreme Court kind of unable to resolve difficult questions, then you get the law changing in different jurisdictions, and it can be a real mess.
Now's your chance to chat with Jeffrey Bellin. He clerked for Judge Merrick Garland, who is the nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. You can join us at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. And we're also on Facebook as well. There are two key cases right now that are of particular notice or particular interest to Virginia, and particularly have implications for the prospect of a 4-4 split. One of them is Governor Bob McDonnell's appeal of his conviction and his sentencing. I wonder what you what your observations are of that, because if it's a 4-4 split, and no way to know what that will be, but if it's a 4-4 split, then that lower court conviction is upheld, correct?
Right, and so for the McDonald case, you know, kind of interesting thing about it, I usually try not to predict votes, but as you know, but Justice Scalia was a very good justice for Bob McDonnell in the sense that there's kind of two wild cards in the analysis of this case. One is a fear that the federal law is too vague, and so it's kind of not fair to criminal defendants in the public corruption context because it's not clear what the law prohibits. And then the other is that the convictions like Bob McDonald's and especially the jury instructions in that case are close to kind of infringing on people's First Amendment right to contribute to politicians they like. And so those cut differently depending on the justice. So it's kind of hard to know how a justice will come out, whether you're kind of more concerned with the First Amendment piece of contributing to campaigns or you're more concerned with the due process piece of giving people notice of what's illegal. And so for a lot of justices, those are going to be in tension. But for Justice Scalia, he was on the same side of both of those, kind of saying that the law has to be clear and there has to be a lot of breathing room for donating to politicians. And so for that reason, you'd predict that Justice Scalia was probably going to be a vote to overturn the conviction. And so if instead we get a 4-4 tie, that would mean that the conviction would stand because that's what the lower court held. And so this could be the difference for Bob McDonnell between not a conviction. And also this would be an example of a place if the court comes down 4-4, where it's a very important question, you know, what are the contours of public corruption law for, across the country? And it's a bad system to have it unclear. It's really dangerous because then you can have, so Bob McDonald is a very prominent figure, and if he shouldn't have been prosecuted, then, that's a huge federal infringement on state government and things like that. And if he should be prosecuted, then they need to make, or it was okay to prosecute him this way. That needs to be clear as well so that politicians across the country get the message. And kind of the worst scenario is just leaving it unclear.
Ajmal is on the line from Newport News. Hi, Ajmal. You're on the air.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Yes. It boggles my mind as to the Republican stand on Merrick Garland. I just don't understand the stand. On one side, Merrick Garland is probably the best option that the Republicans could get as far as a nominee for the Supreme Court from the Democratic side. And Obama went out of his way to nominate a middle-of-the-road justice who is not a radical activist liberal. On the other hand, it's also very cynical, and I just don't understand it, because if Merrick Garland is not given a fair stand, and the hope of the Republicans that a Republican president will come in does not come to fruition, then the potential is there that Obama might withdraw this nomination and let the next Democratic president choose something much more radical or much more of an activist liberal nominee. So I just don't understand how Mr. Mitch McConnell's mindset brought this to a fruition that they wouldn't even care to talk with Merrick Garland. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Ajmal. Jeffrey Bellin, what do you think about Ajmal's point?
Yeah, you know, it gets into political calculations that I'm not a particular expert about. But what struck me about, and you know, I agree that it seems counterintuitive, the stand that the Republicans are taking here. And what strikes me kind of most unfortunate about it is that it's kind of obviously political. And so in the past, when politicians have blocked judges, they'll say, you know, I think Judge Bork was a good example of this. You know, the argument wasn't we're blocking him because we can, or we're blocking him because maybe a better judge will be appointed if our president wins in the next election. The argument was that he was extreme and you know, his positions were not right for the country. And maybe those were disingenuous arguments, but they were plausible arguments. And so, you know, but here, the argument isn't that there's anything about this choice that is wrong for the country. They're kind of saying we're not even going to explore whether this is a qualified justice or not. The argument is just a political argument, and that strikes me as bad for the institutions, both of the Senate and the Supreme Court.
Gray is on the line from Williamsburg with an interesting question. Hi, Gray. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
I wonder if Merrick Garland would be willing to overturn Citizens United, whether or not that's like a known thing, and if it's not, what your views on it would be.
Okay, Gray, thank you for the call. I don't know if you could hear Gray's question, Jeffrey.
Yeah, unfortunately, I could. Wait, it was the amount of the danger of the question for how long it was very impressive. So in this sense, that I can't, there's no way I could say whether, and it's not something, so the answer is it's not something that's known, kind of how we would vote on this case or any case. And my understanding, you know, and I think this is right, is that even the president doesn't ask, this is kind of not, you're not allowed to ask questions like that in the process, or at least, you know, that's the historical tradition, is the presidents won't ask the nominees, you know, how will you vote on this, how will you vote on this? Although you often hear, I think, candidates, and I think Bernie Sanders has said something like that, that he'll have a litmus test for appointees, but I think even he wouldn't ask the nominee that question. I guess he would just try and figure it out from their track record.
And what does that track record suggest around that,
it? And I would just say that there's nothing, you know, there's no way to know. You know, like what I know about the judge is that just he has this process. And so, like, for any case, he would, I think maddeningly so for the people who work for him sometimes, really get into the, you know, exactly what happened in this case, exactly what is the precedent, what does the Constitution say. And I don't think, you know, even he would know how he was going to come out until he went through this process.
Because he's fairly well known for being very thorough on that point. Gray, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. So, all of this is so fascinating because it really has very interesting implications moving forward. One of the other cases we didn't discuss yet has to do with the outline of the 3rd Congressional District. Arguments were presented to the Supreme Court recently in that regard. What are, if there's a 4-4 decision there, what happens? The lower court's upheld, right?
Yeah, again, it would be the same. And actually, so you guys warned me that we talk about this case, and as you may realize, I'm not a election law expert.
But
I'm not like Jeffrey Toobin, who knows everything about the law that could come up. So for this, I talked to my colleague, Professor Rebecca Green, to prep me for this, who's runs our election law clinic,
right,
and is an expert on these matters. And I think has been on the show before.
Absolutely.
And she kind of said in this case, you know, that's the expectation, is they would probably leave the lower court's decision in place anyway. There's kind of been some hints at that. There was a stay that they didn't enter. And then also, I guess it's so close to the actual voting that it would be a real problem to disturb it. And so kind of her take on this is that, you know, either there'll be a tie or they'll just kind of find a way to let the lower court ruling stand, because the law here is such a mess, and why kind of make it even worse?
Really interesting. Jeffrey Bellin, I'm always glad for you to be with us, and I really appreciate your insights on all of this. And I'm just so impressed that you clerked for this man. And so, you know, and you've written an op-ed in support of his confirmation. So we really appreciate that. And I think that makes you even better than Jeffrey Toobin for today.
Oh, wow. Well, all right.
There you go. There you go. I'll look forward to seeing you. I think it's either next week or the week after. I'm going to be speaking to law students up there at the College of William Mary. I look forward to that. So thanks again for being with us. Sure do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. 29 minutes before the hour, and lots going on in Hampton Roads. In just a few minutes, we're going to be talking with John Elder Robison. He's at the College of William & Mary this semester as their neurodiversity scholar. If you have questions about his experience of autism, he's written 4 best-selling books about it. He'll be with us in just a few moments. But we do want to take a minute as well to let you know there are so many events. We are right now in the midst of the Virginia Arts Festival. Some amazing events coming up. Yo-Yo Ma and Emmanuel Axe. Yo-Yo Ma, of course, the world-famous cellist, and Emmanuel Axe, magnificent pianist, are going to be in concert April 12th. And if you go to vafest.org, you can check that out. That's certainly a headlining act. But there are all manner of events, from dance to music to stage, as part of this multi-week festival. Coming up April 13th, we have a number of ballets, and so you can check that out at vafest.org. So tremendous opportunities for you to experience world-class art here in Hampton Roads. The number is 282-2822. That's 282-2822. And so I hope you'll take advantage of that opportunity, because we are the world's artistic stage at this time of year, and a great thing it is, no question about it. I don't know if you're aware of this either, but we have a couple of matinees for you in the afternoon now on WHRO TV 15. And if you are at home in the afternoon, you can watch at 3:30. Doc Martin will be on the air this afternoon on WHRO. Oh, no, that's not right. I'm sorry. I apologize. It's Father Brown today at 3:30, followed by at 4:30, Jewel in the Crown. So they're running from 3:30 to 5:30. Some of these terrific masterpieces. That's just all you can say about that, in a matinee scenario on WHRO TV 15. So lots of opportunities coming up for you. As well, coming up at Hampton Arts, you have the Hillbenders presenting The Who's Tommy. This is a bluegrass Opry. Some of you will remember Tommy the Rock Opera. Well, this is Tommy the Bluegrass Opera. It's coming up this Saturday at 8 o'clock at the American Theater in Hampton. You're going to want to log on to their website, hamptonarts.net. for more details. We'll be back in just a moment. John Elder Robison is an autism advocate who's written 4 books about his own experience of autism. He's lived with it all his life, but didn't get a diagnosis until he was 40. The latest of his 4 books is called Switched On, A Memoir of Brain Change and Emotional Awakening. John Elder Robison is spending the semester at the College of William & Mary as its neurodiversity scholar, and he will be speaking this evening at the College of William & Mary in an event that is designed to honor and commemorate National Autism Month. So we'll have information on that in the course of our conversation as well. Mr. Robison, thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate your being here.
Thanks for inviting me, yes.
I was so intrigued to listen to an interview with you. I think it was on the show Here and Now. And
yeah, a lot of people commented on that.
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh. It was an amazing thing because, and I want to go back to that interview just briefly because I think it sets up so beautifully so much of the work that you've been doing. You were actually contacted by researchers. You have been a very successful person who has leveraged those aspects of autism that gave you extraordinary ability in music and mechanics, and you had this great career going, and all of a sudden you get a call from these researchers. What happened?
Well, they told me they wanted to put some flyers out at one of my talks, and they were beginning a research project where they hoped to use high-powered magnetic fields to induce changes in the brain that would help autistic people to read unspoken cues in other people more successfully. Mm. And I know that sounds like a real crazy science fiction kind of thing, but I should hasten to add that these were Harvard Medical School scientists, not just, you know, whatever.
Right.
And I was just immediately intrigued by that, because even though in your intro you described me as being successful in business and having a wife and a son, even though the wife had turned on me and I got married again, but, you know, I always felt like an outsider. Even though I knew I was successful, I also knew that I flubbed many initial social encounters. And I attributed that to not being able to read the unspoken cues that are such a big part of interaction between people.
So you would know that you had flubbed it based on the people's reaction to it. So this experiment was in some way a chance to sort of access some of those emotional cues. Is that right?
Right. They didn't realize it when they introduced themselves to me, but they were really speaking to something that I felt was a significant trait of disability in me, even as I was a generally successful person.
I think the fascinating part of that story, and boy, you tell it amazingly well in this new book, Switched On, A Memoir of Brain Change and Emotional Awakening, has to do with the way, and I hope you'll forgive me for this, but I think the way some people think about autism, that if there is this piece of emotion that's blocked off, then surely if you just turn that on, then all will be well and right with the world. And I think to some extent you sort of had that sense given your experiences as a child.
Certainly before I did these experiments, if you had asked me, is there a downside to having greater emotional insight or greater emotional intelligence, I would have thought that was like saying, is there an insight to being better at math or a better reader? And I would have thought, of course not. That's crazy. But now, having done it, I realize how naive that viewpoint is. And there is indeed, there can be a great gift, but also a tremendous cost to that kind of insight.
I wonder if you could describe for us, because that was just extraordinary to hear you talk about what happened in terms of your in terms of being around other people, once you started having this experimental process done, how did you experience that in ways that was different than it had been before?
After one of the stimulations, I looked at one of my coworkers the next morning, and I thought to myself, he has those beautiful brown eyes, and an autistic person like me, I probably, in my whole life, I had never ever said he or she has the most beautiful eyes, because I couldn't look in people's eyes. It was the title of my first book, Don't Look Me
Yes.
Look Me in the Eye, because I couldn't do it. And so the idea that I would look at a person and have that thought unbidden, that was just so alien and totally out of character, and yet I say it to you, and you might think that's just the most ordinary thing in the world. I've thought that a million times about people. And that, in a sense, may just show the difference between you and me.
That's fascinating. You also said there were times where you really felt overwhelmed, having not sort of been able to interpret any reactions from people, that you were sort of overwhelmed by the flow of their emotion on you, is it?
That's right, yeah. Before I had done these experiments, I thought, well, more emotional insight can only be a good thing. But when I was looking at people, and I just felt these streams of feeling coming from them as I gazed at them, and it was like I was feeling angst and worry and upset and, you know, all these, yeah, these feelings, and they were just overwhelming to me, and I had to say, I got to go outside for a minute. I would go outside and just sort of cool off, and I realized that these were ordinary conversations in the context of running a service department at a car dealership. I mean, we're not talking here about people telling me incredible, horrible things about their life, and I was just devastated by it.
Wow, that's amazing. As with time, is it like that now? I mean, did it continue that way, or does
no,
the effect
if it
diminish?
Was, if it was like that, I would have been out of work on disability.
Wow.
I couldn't. But luckily, what happened is it kind of trailed down, and I changed gradually, and I guess I became able to the ability diminished, and at the same time, my ability to handle it grew, and I reached a state of equilibrium, but it took me several years to really get there.
That's amazing. We're at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. John Elder Robison, our guest today. He is the visiting scholar at the College of William & Mary. He is their neurodiversity scholar in residence. His new book is called Switched On, A Memoir of Brain Change and Emotional Awakening, and he'll be talking about that tonight at 7 at Tucker Theater at the campus on the College of William & Mary. Like so many of us, you visited Colonial Williamsburg as a child, I understand, with your grandmother, and you discovered these ancestors, Roland and Orlando Jones. Roland Jones, the first minister to preach at Bruton Parish Church. He's buried there, in fact. And then his son Orlando, an early student at the College of William & Mary, who went on to represent Williamsburg in the House of Burgesses. As you think about that family connection, I presume that's a piece of what made this scholar-in-residence opportunity attractive to you.
Well, it's why I'm the scholar in residence, yeah, because you said Orlando was one of the first students, and that's true. But when he finished his education, he began to teach at William & Mary under Blair. And the first American-trained faculty were called the scholars in residence to distinguish them from the English-trained masters.
Oh, how interesting.
So my title of a scholar in residence actually honors that of my eighth grandfather, who was the first scholar in residence at this college's founding.
Wow.
And one thing that's really significant to me is that I, at my age now, can look at five generations of my family line, and I can see autism in all five of them.
Really?
So when I look back down that line, back as far as my great-grandparents, which are as far back as living memory as I have, and they were autistic, pointing towards Roland and Orlando Jones, I think, what are the odds that they were autistic too? And it's surely better than chance with all the autism in my family. And even though I can never know the answer to that question, it's a real interesting thing to think. Why is it that these ancestors of mine were great men and instrumental in the establishment of Virginia and this college, and yet autistic people of my generation are seen as total failures, and we can't get out of high school, let alone gain admission to a college like this. So, and it suggests that something's gone wrong with the system.
And when you say something's gone wrong with the system, I think that's such an interesting point. You've observed it now for a long time. What do you think might explain that? What ideas do you have about that?
I think one big thing that's changed is that we don't have a community anymore. When a person who was different grew up in Colonial Williamsburg, the people all around him knew him all his life, so he wasn't really an alien or an outsider. But so often, young people today move into communities where their parents and they don't know anyone. And so when they're strange there, they're automatically excluded. And I think that then we have the problems in school where we teach abstract ideas in textbooks instead of teaching learning by doing, and kids who are different often can't pass that. And if they can't pass, they're blocked for employment and full participation in adult life in America. And I think, frankly, it's a real tragedy. That's what we're trying to address with the Neurodiversity Initiative here at William & Mary. We're trying to change that for our own students and for our graduates influencing the wider world.
And so I wonder, as you talk with students with autism who are enrolled at the College of William & Mary, can you tell us about what some of those conversations are like? I mean, I'm guessing they're just thrilled to have you there.
Well, I think one important thing is that, if I might be so bold as to suggest it, most of us don't think that we are students or people with autism. We think that we are autistic people, just as we think that we're a Jewish or Native American or Christian people, as opposed to people with Judaism or people with Catholicism.
See, can I stop you there for 1 second? I want to ask you about that, because this is so interesting. In the world of lexicography, I don't know what the word is, in the world of words, what we've always been told, those of us who sort of host shows and what have you, is that you don't say a person is a thing. You say they have a thing. But for you, this is very interesting, because what you're saying is this is fundamental and it shapes who you are. So you are that thing, right?
Well, I'm not exclusively that thing, but I'm partly that thing. I think that you say that, you know, he's got measles or he's got cancer. It's a thing you don't want. You have it. You got it. But I can say I'm an autistic person. It shapes my life, and it's part of who I am. I think even in the case of some diseases, people do that. Like a person might say, I'm a diabetic, because those words paint a picture of the kind of diet I might eat or the things I might do, because it's not, you know, going to kill me, but it's a part of who I am, and it shapes me. Autism is not a disease. It's a different way of being. For some of us, it is a crushing disability. For others, it is a set of extraordinary gifts. Mm-hmm. And autistic people can be found at all points on that continuum.
We're at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. John Elder Robison will be speaking tonight at 7 at the campus of the College of William & Mary in the Tucker Theater. April, coming up next month, National Autism Awareness Month. Sharon's on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Sharon, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you all?
Fine, thanks.
Yes.
Hi, I listen to you, and it brings a very deep emotion to me. I have a 24-year-old nonverbal autistic son, and I've been on this journey for a fair long time. 20 years ago, I started a nonprofit locally, just so you know what's happening in this area with autism, called FACT, Families of Autistic Children in Tidewater. And we serve over 400 kids and adults a year, soup to nuts, low-functioning, self-injurious to high-functioning. I, for a brief second, don't understand why they're there. And then I watch and I listen and I understand. But to hear you speak gives me a slight beacon of hope for my son who cannot speak, and not knowing what his emotions are and not knowing what his attunement is to social cues and so forth. I had someone recently say to me, oh, he doesn't know. He's happy. Well, I argue that he does know. Mm. And where he might be a happy person because we've dedicated our life to his happiness, I wonder about that emotional awareness that he might have, and he's not able to talk to me because for 24 years he's never said a word in his life, yet I know what he wants, what he needs, and what he's thinking. And listening to you describe what you have experienced on a very, very high level of function gives me a little hope that maybe I can think that he also has these deep understandings. Mm. And the other thing I wanted to just mention that you said that really resonated is this going back and seeing it in all of the generations that you can track, going backwards, and why is it not happening in our society today for people to raise to these great level of academic achievements as your ancestors did? And I could argue that in education today, everybody needs to be on page 6.
Mm. Interesting point, Sharon. I thank you for the call. You know, I, Mr. Robinson, I wonder, Sharon says your story gives her hope, and I was thinking about the wide range of ways in which autism presents itself.
Well, people do say that because in my earlier books, like in Look Me in the Eye, I wrote about the things adults said about me when I was a lonely kid on the playground, not talking to other people, not really having any friends. So I was a picture of an isolated child with a disability in those years. And yet I did emerge to a significant degree from disability, even as I remained just as autistic as I always was as I grew up. And I think that that is both a true and an inspiring idea, that the recognition that we will always be autistic, but that our disability may well diminish significantly as we learn coping skills and strategies as we get older. And also as our brains develop, another thing that people often find inspiring is to look at video of me or to see me in person today versus 10 years ago and to see how much I have changed and acquired skills in my what's now 50, in my 50s.
Right.
So they look at their own children, they say, well, my son's 19 or my son's 25, and I'm over twice that age and I'm still acquiring skills. And how can that not be hopeful?
Yeah, great point. You know, as you think about this technique that you went through, and you talked a little bit about changing the education system, and then the coping mechanisms, it sounds like it's a sort of a multifaceted approach, because definitely not a one size fits all answer to this. Because I think a lot of people are sort of searching out there, trying to find, well, if we can find this one thing, then that will change things.
People think that there's one answer, and there's not. Autism is a way of being that that is kind of threaded all through us. And like I said, it can present gifts. And for example, my fixation on things. When I was a boy in school and I wouldn't do anything except what I was interested in, it caused me to fail in my classes. But when I focus on electronics to the exclusion of all else as an adult, people say I'm a brilliant engineer. So the very same trait can be both gift and disability, depending on your perspective.
It's such a great point. Go ahead.
And I with respect to this, the brain stimulation that I describe in this, in my Switched On book, we really, in these experiments, attempted to target something that's an aspect of disability for many people, and that is reading unspoken emotional cues. But TMS is a little-known tool of neurologists that's being used to potentially attack things that are truly life-threatening, like, for example, to suppress epileptic seizures. And there are so many different, and that's a big issue in the autism community, there's so many different problems that we could apply these emerging technologies to, but none of them are curing autism. None of them are changing the essence of who we are. They are remediating things that disable us, specific things.
It's just been such a pleasure to talk with you, and I'm so glad you're there at William & Mary. How long will you be the neurodiversity scholar in residence?
Well, I hope it's an indefinite thing.
Great.
That my ancestor represented William & Mary first as a scholar and then a provost and then as the college counsel, and he represented the college all his life.
Well, I wish you the very same thing. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you. I really appreciate your being here, and we'll look forward to inviting folks to your appearance tonight at 7 at the Tucker Theater at the campus of the College of William & Mary, April National Autism Awareness Month. John Elder Robinson, thank you so much for being with us today. Surely do appreciate it.
What?
Thank you so much. His new book is called Switched On, A Memoir of Brain Change and Emotional Awakening. But he's the author of three other books, all bestsellers as well. One called Raising Cubby, A Father and Son's Adventures with Asperger's, Trains, Tractors, and High Explosives. one called Be Different, and then one, of course, the one that really, really put him on the stage for this work is called Look Me in the Eye, My Life with Asperger's. John Elder Robison with us today. Thank you so much for being with us and for being part of the conversation. I have to tell you, that event will be a great one tonight, March 28th, that's tonight, 7 o'clock, at Tucker Theater at the College of William and Mary. Tomorrow in this space, we're going to be talking about the backlash over this recent series of state bills all across the country that are causing many organizations and companies to bring their financial muscle to bear in hopes of stopping what some are calling anti-LGBT legislation. We'll talk about that tomorrow. We hope we can also keep the conversation going on Twitter and Instagram using the handle at Kathy Lewis Talks, or you can always, always, always email your show ideas to hearsay at WHRV. So much going on in Hampton Roads this spring season. We've got great shows for you all week. Don't forget about Lantern Asia, art by day, magic by night. It's going to be fantastic over at the Botanical Garden. So I hope you will get over there and enjoy that. As well, we want to let you know that the Chrysler Museum of Art has that Edward Bertinsky water exhibit underway, and that goes through May 15th, so that's a great opportunity for you as well. And again, don't forget to check out the Virginia Arts Festival for lots going on there as well. Up next here on 89.5, it's Making Contact and a couple of great programs coming up tonight on WHRO TV 15 at 8 o'clock. It is back-to-back episodes of your Antiques Roadshow with stops in Tucson for an appraisal of a 1943 Allen Ginsberg signed yearbook. So that's coming up at 8. And then at 10 o'clock, it's Independent Lens presenting An Honest Liar. Meet James, the amazing Randy, the famed magician who has dedicated his life to exposing fraud. So that's coming up tonight at 10 on WHRO TV 15. So tomorrow we will look at some of those laws that are being enacted all over the country, not the least of which in North Carolina, where they have passed a measure that prevents cities from banning discrimination against LGBT individuals. On Wednesday, we'll take a look at the city of Portsmouth facing continuing challenges, including a $3.5 million budget deficit. And then on Thursday, our good friend Dr. Phyllis Newman will be joining us to talk about your pets and to answer questions about your pets, particularly this time of year. Lots of puppies being born right about now, lots of puppies being adopted. So we'll talk with Phyllis Newman. And by the way, we're looking for your stories about the pet that has changed your life. So we'll share those as well. You can post those stories at our Facebook page, along with any comments that you may not have had the opportunity to get into recent shows. We always look forward to hearing from you there as well. Well, I think that just about wraps it up for us today. We'll see you right back here tomorrow and look forward to that. In the meantime, stay in touch. We'll see you tomorrow.